Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we begin our program by talking with Georgia Pellegrini. Georgia is a classically trained chef who decided she needed to have a more intimate relationship with the meat that she was preparing and eating. And she chronicled her journey in her new book. It's called Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat, One Hunt at a Time. And as someone who hunts, I hunt deer and pheasants and turkey and do some fishing as well, and also teach a cooking class from time to time. I was intrigued by the book and fascinated in reading her accounts, and I'm really happy to have her along today. She joins us from radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. Georgia, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Hi. You're not on a hunt down there, are you?
Not today.
not today. Well, tell you what, as we visit with her, maybe you'd like to talk about what hunting means to you. Maybe it's changed. Has it changed your relationship with food? If you don't hunt, do you eat meat? How do you feel about hunters? Would you do it if you had the chance? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there on the Larry Mueller Show. Well, you left a career in finance to follow your heart into the kitchen. I mean, this started, it seems a little out of character for someone who graduated from Harvard and then who was classically trained as a chef to wind up as a hunter.
Yes, it definitely isn't the traditional path they teach in college. But I have to say, you know, I think the path of least resistance coming out of college for a lot of people used to be, if it isn't now, finance or consulting. And so I just sort of dove in and realized very quickly it wasn't a good fit for me. And the silver lining, of course, when you're not doing something that makes you happy is it forces you to think about what you're doing when you are happy. And for me, it was always food. It was always cooking. And so I took a leap of faith.
Yeah. And then while you were working in a restaurant, you were sent out to kill turkeys to be used for the day's menu.
Yeah. I had worked at farm-to-table restaurants in New York and in France, and that was sort of the type of restaurant I chose to work at simply because I had grown up living off the land. I had grown up foraging and fishing, and my family members could name all of the plants on our land. And so I always felt a deep connection to the land that I lived on. So I was working at these farm-to-table restaurants, and one of them asked us to kill 5 turkeys for the kitchen. And that was my watershed moment. I thought, wow, you know, I've fished, I've foraged, I grew up with chickens and honeybees, but no one's ever asked me to just do it myself, to bring my ingredients to my table in such a primal way. And it was an emotional, intense moment, but it was very transformative because it forced me to realize that if I'm going to be a chef, if I'm going to be a meat eater, for me, it was important to be able to do this, to pay the full karmic price of the meal, to really face my food head on and also be able to treat it with integrity from the field to the plate, and know that nothing was wasted and know that it had a good life.
Here in Wisconsin, there's been a lot of research done on hunting and people who hunt. And typically, if someone hunts in Wisconsin, they often, more often than not, they're from a rural area and their father hunted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that predicts. But in your case, I'm not sure that that's the case for you.
It's not. And I think that there is this this thought among people who live in urban areas that it is something that if they didn't grow up with it, if their father didn't teach them, then it's not accessible to them. And, you know, I did grow up in a very... in an area where it was close enough to Manhattan. It was about 45 minutes, but it was definitely, I was living off the land. But I didn't grow up hunting. My dad didn't teach me how to hunt. My grandfather didn't teach me how to hunt. It was something that happened as a chef. And my goal with this book is to make people realize that it's accessible in the sense that we were all once hunter-gatherers. And if you do care where your food comes from, if you care about going to the farmer's market and knowing where your vegetables or your meat came from, this isn't a far step from that. This is really, it's a matter of finding someone to teach you.
Yeah. And you started on it was kind of a quest for you, wasn't it? I mean, to hunt different types of games and prepare a game and then prepare them in a sort of gourmet fashion.
It was a quest. You know, I think it's very easy when you're in a professional kitchen just to have the ingredients delivered and not really think about it. But for me, I realized I really wanted to step outside of our whole industrial food system, to step outside our feedlot culture with animals and really source my ingredients as much of myself as I could. And it was a fascinating experience in the sense that I met all of these characters along the way that were very different in a lot of ways, whether it was in Northern England, where they wear bow ties when they go hunting, or in the Mississippi Delta, in the heart of Arkansas, you know, where they have their cigars and their scotch. They had very different lives, but what united them was their desire to live off the best that their hands could produce. And that was a really fascinating thing to see how culturally different it could be, yet they were all united by that one thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry to get to the end and realize that, she didn't make it to Wisconsin.
I didn't make it to Wisconsin this time, unfortunately. Next one.
next one, you'll have to do it. Well, you certainly meet some great great places and great people, I thought. I enjoyed your conversations about the village and people like the Kamish. They hold a special meaning for you, I think, don't they?
They do. They are my teachers, you know, and I went into this a little bit wide-eyed, and I get a lot of once-overs when people, when I tell people that I hunt. I guess there's this idea that the profile of the American hunter is a man, and, you know, maybe probably a middle-aged man, white man, and I don't fit any of that criteria. And so it takes people a little while to sort of digest it sometimes. But, you know, there are more and more women hunters. It's growing very fast, and it's a wonderful thing to realize that women are great cooks. Why couldn't they be great at bringing the food home as well? So the Kamish and the people in the village and all of the characters I met were my teachers. And they taught me, you know, I always loved the outdoors, but they taught me an appreciation for the outdoors that was new. I looked at it in a whole new way, whether it's hearing the woods wake up or feeling those rhythms of nature. It's a totally different way of being alive.
Yeah, it is, and you're really a good writer and write very well about it. It's fun reading your writing, for sure. Jean in Almond, Wisconsin, has a comment or question. Hi, Jean. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'd just like to say that I think it's refreshing to have somebody advocate knowing where your food comes in total, whether you hunt it or you raise it and slaughter it yourself or if you don't. I think people have to realize that all living things, whether plant or animal, they more or less give their lives for sustaining us. And that's the way it is in the natural world. And I'm enjoying your program. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Comment, Georgia?
It's true, actually. One of the first things somebody told me in Arkansas over a cigar and scotch, he sat there in front of the fire and said, if you're going to eat, something's got to die, whether it's animal protein or vegetable protein. And for me, that was a profound moment because I realized, you know, that's the cycle of life. You know, we eat animals and plants, animals eat plants and animals feed from the dirt, and we all turn to dirt. And it's an unavoidable cycle. So why not participate in it?
You talk about the paradox of people who raise cattle to sell to feedlots, but also often earn money from opening their land up to hunters. And you hold that up, I think, as being about as opposite a view of food and meat as you can have. What'd you learn from being in those places?
Yeah, it was fascinating to see the way hunting fits into people's lives. A lot of ranches around the country raise cattle, and yet they also allow people to come and hunt. And, you know, it's an interesting system that the way our feedlots have consolidated over time. It used to be that farmers were allowed to slaughter their own animals and sell them. And now, with our increasingly oppressive regulations, it's harder to do that. And you have to consolidate and drive really long distances to be able to slaughter your animals. And as a result, you know, a lot of animals are stuffed into a certain confined space, which is not good for anybody. It's not good for their health, which in turn isn't good for ours. And what's interesting about these ranches is that they'll often raise them on grass and then end up having to send them off to a feedlot to finish on corn. But yet they also host hunts. So it's definitely, you still see both of those worlds walking side by side.
Yeah. I had a comment from Mary on my Facebook page a long time ago. A college friend ate only meat that she harvested. It made so much sense, and I try to do that. We do mostly eat venison and the fish we catch, and we buy poultry from Mennonite farmers down the road who've made the hens earn their keep by eating bugs in the gardens. You are making people aware of something very important, Georgia, and thanks. So nice comment.
Oh. Well, you know, I think it's important to realize, you know, I think my goal for this wasn't that I expected everyone to suddenly go out hunting. I don't expect everyone will be able to do that. But I do think that I hope it will change the conversation. It will change the conversation about where our food comes from and what we expect in terms of the kind of food we're offered as omnivores, as true omnivores. And I think the more we know, our standards will change. We'll start to demand higher quality food.
We have Carolyn and Madison up next. Let's turn there. Hi, Carolyn. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Here in Madison, they're going to cull the deer from our conservation parks. Apparently, we have an awful lot.
Yes.
And a columnist in the local paper suggested that we put this venison on the menu at local restaurants. And I thought, oh, wow, great. I'd love that. And I think geese were in there, too, where you have to cull geese, and we thought that would be good on the menu as well. But I mostly thought, well, you know, these people out there shooting the deer and geese or whatever would just be approaching the whole process of killing something differently if they knew it was going to be food rather than, I don't know, well, maybe they do feed them to somebody, but
yeah.
Just the process of approaching an animal as if it's going to feed somebody.
Mm-hmm. Comment, Georgia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's always been about food. It always comes back to, what am I going to make with this? And, you know, I get teased a lot because when I see a bunch of small pigs running across the road, I see visions of sausages. And I actually will also say, wow, those look good. And people will laugh at me because I literally am seeing, you know, the dish I'm going to make out of them. And so that's what it's ultimately about for me. I mean, bringing food and sharing it with friends and family. I mean, that's, food is about bringing people pleasure and happiness ultimately. And that's why everyone loves it. It's a unifying force. You know, it's tricky because we have these weird laws where we're not allowed to sell in restaurants animals that have been hunted in the wild. That's not the case over in the UK, for example. In fact, in the UK, you can go to a market and you can buy a woodcock, for example, and they'll tell you what forest it came from.
Yeah.
Here, we can't do that because, you know, there were laws set back in, I think, the 20s to prevent market hunting and prevent poaching and such, which made sense to a degree. But I think there needs to be a greater acceptance of where hunting and game animal fits into our diet. Not everything has to be farmed in order for it to be considered acceptable at the dinner table or at a restaurant menu. So I hope they find a way to serve those mm-hmm. deer and geese at the restaurant.
And you find, maybe you find this too. I know you've eaten venison from that has been, say, pen raised, versus a deer that you shoot in the wild, and certainly the taste isn't quite the same. Not to me, anyway.
Definitely not. It's, you know, that's what's been challenging and interesting coming at this from as a chef. Wild animals are athletes. They run free. They eat whatever they please, and they exercise constantly. And so every animal is going to have a different flavor. It's going to be a new culinary adventure. Whereas farm-raised animals are all fed the same diet. They live in the same confined space. And so they taste the same. And so for me, when I eat beef or chicken from a grocery store now, it's just incredibly bland, simply because it just doesn't have that same flavor variety that I'm used to.
Georgia Pellegrini, our guest today, she is the author of Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat, One Hunt at a Time. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Georgia Pellegrini, classically trained chef who decided she needed to have an intimate relationship with the meat that she was preparing and eating. And her journey is chronicled in her new book. It's called Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat, One Hunt at a Time. And you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call or go to my Facebook page and post there at The Larry Mueller Show. Mike in West Dallas, I'm going to turn to you next. Thank you.
Hi,
for
Larry.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for calling.
I used to fish a lot as a kid, but not so much anymore. And I saw a fascinating program on the humane way of harvesting fish. But it's not necessarily for eco tree huggers. It's because the flavor of the fish has an impact on how stressed the fish is before you kill it. So when I see the stringers with fish basically slowly suffocating, those hormones in that fish make that meat very unpleasant. So the answer to that would be basically knock out a fish as soon as you get it, because once the fish is dead, it's not going to create any more off taste. And this program was on public television, and it had that technique. I think they were harvesting tuna or something to that effect, where basically they just bled the fish before they had any chance of having their stress hormones basically cause the meat to degrade faster or to taste funny.
Hmm. I think some of that holds true for animals as well. Georgia, comment?
It's very true, actually, exactly what he was saying. And also with fish, when you cook it, and if you ever see that white stuff come out of salmon, for example, when you're cooking it, it's called albumin. And it's because the salmon has been damaged when it was on the ship. It was either banged around on the ship too much, or the tissues were torn. So it's a sign of how well your fish was treated when it was caught. And it's the same with that with wild game as well. You know, for me, it's very important to have a clean shot and have an instant death. And, you know, that affects, obviously, the flavor of the meat. And, you know, certain animals are gamier than others. And that's one of the things that I experimented a lot with when I was writing my book. The book is also full of recipes. And me, it's full of, you know, brines and marinades and sauces. And because it's more challenging to cook game meat, you really think about how you're going to approach it. For example, if it was a duck that was eating lots of fish, you know, maybe the skin will taste fishy. And the way you taste any animal's flavor is with its fat. Every animal carries its flavor in its fat. So you render the fat, taste it, and see how it tastes. And then you adjust accordingly how you're going to cook it. So for me, especially with wild game, it's marinades and brines are very important to help it retain moisture. Rubs are great. And all kinds of sauces are in there as well.
It's some wonderful, I can't wait to try some of these recipes out. In fact, the pheasant leg with cabbage and grapes, something I'm going to be trying. As you well know, the pheasant leg is, pheasant's legs are
oh yeah, they're tough.
Tough, and they need to be.
They're good runners.
Yeah, they sure are. They surely are. Lynn and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, Larry. I grew up on the south suburbs of Chicago, and we didn't do a lot of hunting. And I've been up in Eau Claire for 25 years, and it always, some of the folks here portray it as kind of a blood sport, and it's just, it was a turnoff. And I've been cooking, I've been dealing with meat, I know where it comes from. My grandmother was raised on a farm, I've seen chickens and pigs and cows slaughtered. But I talked to a hunter recently whose father taught him one shot, clean kill, respect your animal. And he uses one shot, he waits, and he caresses the animal and mm-hmm. thanks her for giving up. And it's a karmic thing. And what was once, you know, even though it's food, the way it was gone about getting was just very primal and unappetizing to me. I couldn't eat it because of that. And now it's kind of the ultimate sacrifice in a beautiful way.
Mm. Mm. That's so true. It's a very spiritual thing, and it sounds strange sometimes when I say that, but most people who have hunted will agree. You know,
yes.
it's a moment of really deep, you know, you're very grateful, and it's very spiritual, and it's emotional. It's some people still cry. You know, it's an emotional moment.
It is.
You know, the Native Americans used to eat the heart as a way to inherit the spirit of their animal. And I've actually, you know, I eat the heart, I eat the liver, I don't waste any of it. And I've taught veteran hunters actually how good it can taste, who never imagined it could taste, you know, they could eat those kinds of parts. So it's important to have that moment and that connection with the experience, I think.
Lynn, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Dennis in Friendship a chance to join in. Dennis, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for putting me on. I learned hunter safety before I learned how to hunt. And I think it's always important to know how to be safe, whether you're carrying a rifle or a bow, whatever it is. My uncle taught me this, and he also taught me how to hunt. The one thing that he taught me, I'd like to share with your listeners, is kind of contrary to one of your previous callers. My uncle taught me that you don't shoot anything unless you intend to eat it. And that separates hunting, at least in my mind, and I think a lot of other people I know, from some kind of sport as far as seeing how much you can hit or kill or how good a shot you are. It's relative to hunting, which is relative to eating. I think that's what your guest is trying to say, the same thing. The simple rule is don't shoot it if you're not going to eat it.
Yeah. Or unless someone else. Sometimes the food goes, the meat goes to others. As in the earlier caller you were talking, you mentioned the earlier caller, and I think those people who will be thinning the herd of deer herd in the Madison area, that meat will be going to food pantries.
Mm-hmm. That's common, yeah. And, you know, I he's right. I mean, it's important for me. I think that maybe part of why hunting gets this bad rap is that people think it's just a sport. And for me, I keep making that connection to the food. That's why the book had to have recipes, you know, because it really is about the dinner table at the end of the day and sort of stepping outside the traditional grocery aisle way of getting your ingredients. And like you were saying, too, you know, a gun is a tool the same way a hammer or a knife is for me. It's just a means of bringing food to the table. So I think that's important. You know, safety is important. And it's important that you teach people safety with it. Abroad, it's actually considered a form of sophistication to learn how to use a gun properly. And in here, we have a very tense relationship with that whole.
Yeah, I think in Germany, there's quite a testing. You know, you have to take a test.
It's like 2 years to be able to really hunt in Germany.
Yeah, it's quite different. Well, speaking of safety, I mean, you had there's a chapter or two in your book. I'm thinking, oh, how did she get herself into this mess? Oh my goodness!
I have people email me and say, "I'm staying up all night reading your book, making sure you got out of Wyoming okay."
Yeah.
So, well, the fact that I'm responding should tell you I'm alive and I'm well.
Oh boy! Yep.
Yeah.
Well, as with everything else, there are people who are ethical and great people, and there are other people who maybe aren't quite so much. Yep.
It's true with hunting as with life, you're guided by your own moral compass, especially when you're out there by yourself in the wild. You have just yourself to answer to.
We have Valerie and Maple on board here. Val, hi! Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, because this is somebody who worked for many, many decades in Wisconsin, and this is Frances Hammerstrom.
Yes.
And Frances and her husband, Frederick, did prairie chicken studies in central Wisconsin for a long time, and she's well known. And she has written a book called The Wild Food Cookbook.
Yes.
And it goes through the year by month and talks about not just wild game, but all kinds of wild food that you can collect in Wisconsin, and she has her recipes for it, and it's a charming book, and it's illustrated by her daughter Elva.
Yes,
and I just wondered if Larry especially knew that book.
I actually interviewed Frances about the book.
Yes, and so it's quite delightful, and so I thought your guest might want to get a copy of that. if it's still available, and possibly look through that because I really like it. Now, she also wrote a book, which I read many years ago, and I can't find a title for, and I don't seem to have a copy. And it's about her experiences hunting, because she was also a hunter. And she would go out with the men, and she did this way before a lot of women went out hunting.
Yeah.
And the comment that I remember as a woman hunter myself is the expression that the men would look at her and they would say, "Is she coming too?" which I found quite delightful. And I've seen that myself when I go out to hunt, and if there's a gaggle of guys, it's like they'll make comments like, "My wife always goes shopping during opening season, or opening weekend during deer season," and they look at me like, "Why aren't you shopping?" anyway, so it's fun and it's nice, and as a woman, I think that and I don't know if you've had this experience, but I think I'm a little more tender-hearted than the men that I know, because as a previous caller already said, I do cry.
Yeah.
I just get so emotional about the deer that I've just shot. And again, it's a very respectful process, but I do love wild game.
Oh.
And find it much better than any other kind of meat that you can eat. But we also collect other kinds of wild food besides that, which we also love.
Great.
So I'll take my question off the air, and you can comment. But I do highly recommend Frances's book.
And I, knowing from your writing, Georgia, I can tell you that you would enjoy Frances Hammerstrom's writing as well. So I hope you do get a chance to go online. Frances Hammerstrom, and I can't recall the titles, but she's a one. You would love to meet her. Would have loved to meet her.
The art of knowing what wild edibles are is a wonderful thing, and it's a lost art. My great aunt used to name every plant on our land, and she knew the name of everything. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to tell what's edible and to go out and get wild garlic and make soup out of it. So,
yeah, absolutely. We had a Facebook comment from Seth, who says, "Love that you are a positive role model for girl and women hunters. I have a 13-year-old daughter who loves to hunt, and it's often hard for her to find others with similar interests."
Hmm. That's great. You know, I think one of the most gratifying things about having written this book is all of the people telling me that their wives, who, like she was saying, used to go shopping on opening day of deer season, are now joining their husbands, or are now, you know, starting to just be inspired to participate in some way with them, whether it's maybe just fishing or maybe just go hunting for morels. It's changed the way they view what their husband is doing. And same with the daughters. And I think that there's a very rapidly increasing number of women who are starting to do this and realize it's not just a male sport, so to speak. It's a part of life. We were all once hunter-gatherers.
Bruce in Apple River, Illinois. We turn to you next. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on. I live in far northwest Illinois, right by the Wisconsin border. And I'm sitting right now on an errand right in the middle of a cornfield. And my neighbors are all farmers and hunters. But I decided decades ago that I was not willing personally to slaughter an animal for food, so I don't eat any meat. And what worries me is that I have neighbors, one who just celebrated 150 years of having a dairy on the same family-owned farm, who take very good care of their animals, and they're being forced out by industrial agriculture that's coming in with these huge facilities. And it completely changes the relationship that people have with their animals. This dairy, they know all their cows by names. They live there for 10, 12, 15 years. And it goes back to what your guest is talking about, respect for the animal and where we get our food from. And modern facilities don't treat the animals the same way, and that respect is gone, that connection to nature is gone. And unfortunately, that's where far too much of our meat and dairy is coming from in this country.
Mm-hmm. Comment, Georgia?
It's true. Unfortunately, like I was saying, things are being consolidated in a way that's just really unhealthy. When you have to have 80,000 cattle in one space, There's bound to be disease, and how do you prevent that disease? You inject them with hormones and inject them with antibiotics, and they have all kinds of disease from eating corn that they shouldn't be eating. And our food system is contaminated, and then we go and eat those animals and drink their milk. And I don't know exactly why, you know, our government thinks this is the way things should be, but you know, the local dairy should be allowed to remain a local dairy, and the USDA regulations shouldn't be so cumbersome such that they can't continue to stay in business. It's a real problem. And you know, I think that's why I want this book to create this conversation, that even if you decide you can't hunt, you can certainly insist on supporting your local dairy, and you can insist on stepping outside the grid and stepping outside of that industrial food system a little bit.
Thanks again, Bruce, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Joanne in Sturgeon Bay a chance to join in. Joanne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much. I just wanted to say that my daughter, when she was homeschooling up in Minnesota, was not a hunter, but she, because of the homeschooling, wanted her children to surely know where their food came from. So she raised rabbits. And they never slaughtered the ones with names. But and she was a zoology major, so she already knew how to skin an animal. But she did that for quite a while, and it was very memorable for the children. And also, another aside about Fran Hammerstrom, I know one of her books where she does go into some of the hunting is strictly for the chickens, but there might be one that does more of it. But I just thought this was so special of my daughter to be able to come up with this.
Mm-hmm. Comment, Georgia?
Yeah, you know, I think that I noticed that a lot of children don't have a hard time seeing this process at all. I find that it's usually the adults that have the harder time. Children are actually fascinated by it. They ask questions. They want to participate in hunting and butchering and skinning. I also think it's a wonderful alternative to staying inside and playing video games and being on the computer. I think to really instill the love of the outdoors onto young people is so important, and it's lost a little bit. You know, I grew up, you know, pushing a fat worm onto a hook and fishing my trout for breakfast. And that doesn't really seem to happen as much anymore, unfortunately. I think that the age of smartphones and, you know, Facebook and all of that is sort of changing our relationship with nature. And there's nothing like being outside and hearing the woods wake up. And I wish and I hope that we start to the pendulum start to swing back, and we start to really encourage that more and more.
Yeah, there's nothing like an early morning during turkey hunting season to hear the owl hoot and the gobbler to gobble back at the owl.
Yep, absolutely.
Or the train whistle, the gobbler. They'll gobble at pretty much anything. It's really fun to, it's a wonderful experience to wake up to with the woods.
It's true, and to know that that even happens. I mean, before I started hunting, I didn't realize that the owl agitates the turkey and the turkey responds. You know, I mean, that's amazing.
Mark in Green Bay, on to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, yeah. There's nothing like the morning of a waterfowl opening hunt, half hour before dawn, people putting down blasts of three shots at ducks that they can't identify because it's too dark. I'm here to call into question the ethics of waterfowl hunters. I think they are the biggest, lobbyist hunters anywhere. It's always a pattern of three shots. Hit what you can, see what you get after you have it in hand. Hunting over impenetrable spans of cane without a dog where you'll never have a chance of retrieving the duck. Can you address waterfowl hunting?
Well, I think that it varies. I mean, I've been waterfowl hunting where that isn't the case, and I have been on the hunts where it does feel a little bit like a fraternity outing, and everyone's hooting and hollering, and it feels a little bit unfair. And I have a lot of moments in the book where I talk about, you know, is this fair? Did I have to work hard enough for this?
Yes.
Have I struggled enough? And there are moments when I decide not to shoot because I don't feel like I have had to work hard enough. And I think that's important. And I think, once again, it goes back to your own moral compass, you know, the idea of does this feel right to you? And unfortunately, some people have weaker moral compasses than others. And some hunting is now just sort of, you know, an alternative to a golf outing, and it's not really a challenge, and it's not really about the food, it's just about the sport. And so I don't pursue that kind of hunting personally. But I think that most, I find that outdoorsmen are incredibly ethical overall. People who love the outdoors have a tremendous respect for nature, and they want to just be out there. There's always the exception to any rule, like you're pointing out, but, you know, I think it's all very individual.
Thank you, Mark. Billy in New Glarus, want to give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I actually gave the name Billy in homage to my mother, who grew up hunting back in the 30s and the 40s and continued to do so until she married my dad, who was against hunting. He did not grow up with it, and he spent 2 years over in Italy during World War II and really didn't want to have anything to do with guns much after that. Whereas Mom was going to teach us to hunt, and my grandfather's, her father's gun collection disappeared when I was about 11, right before I was supposed to get my 22.
Oh.
And so, you know, there was speculation as to whether or not Dad had anything to do with that gun collection disappearing. But both my brother and I wound up learning to hunt on our own. He hunted waterfowl, and I've done upland game, waterfowl, mammals, large mammals and small. I was a professional wildlife ecologist, and I also, since I was pretty young, have been writing poetry. While I was a student at Iowa State, a number of my poems were published in the departmental newsletter, which is actually a format that they train conservation writers, natural resource writers at Iowa State. There's a program, it's a joint between animal ecology and journalism. Of course, Ding Darling was quite a well-known person in that area in Iowa, both political mm-hmm. cartoons as well as his writing in favor of conservation and all. And I was actually given a small scholarship by the Ding Darling Foundation on the basis of my poetry, particularly one that I wrote about hunting. And I was asked to read that at the annual dinner. I was really shy and scared of public speaking at the time, and so I was really happy to be able to tell them that I was still going to be in Florida doing my research, but I recorded the poem and sent the tape up. You know, it's some 12 or 14 minutes long, but you know, one of the last lines in it is, you know, I send a prayer of thanks to his God and mine after shooting a deer.
Final comment, Georgia?
I think she's just tapping into sort of what hunting is. It's a tapping into our original human instincts. It's about tapping into the spirituality of it and being part of that cycle of life. And the food tastes so much better that way.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you with us today. I hope you have a chance to come and hunt in Wisconsin someday.
I do too.
It's a great state with a lot of great people, and you've written a wonderful book. We've talked a little bit about the serious side of things here, but there's a lot of humor in your book as well, and a lot of pretty good writing. So thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. Georgia Pellegrini is author of the book Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat One Hunt at a Time. Some great stories in the book and about her experiences. And also, you're going to hang on to the book once you get it, because there are some wonderful recipes as well. At least they look great. I'm going to be trying a few of them out for sure. And it's probably something you might be interested in doing as well. She shared one great way to enjoy the outdoors. When we come back, we'll talk about enjoying the Wisconsin winter by cross-country skiing. Chad McGrath, author of numerous guides for getting the most out of the winter landscape of the upper Midwest, coming up next here on the Ideas Network.